Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program of the economic dimensions of our lives. My name is Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life, and I'm your host on this program every week. I teach at an American university, the New School University in New York City, and I also write columns for a variety of publications. These include truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis every day. And I urge you to check out truthout.org. I also ask you to take a look at our websites, where you will find much more of the information we do here. And I will have more to say about those websites, rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info, toward the end of this program. Both of those websites also allow you to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Pinterest. Let's get right to the shorter economic updates before I introduce my guest for today's interview. I begin, as I have other programs, with news from Detroit. Over the last few months, in fact, of all of 2014, 27,000 residences in Detroit have had their water cut off. So in addition to the calamities that afflict that city, all of which result from the decisions of three huge corporations, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, to move production out of the city, abandoning people without jobs, abandoning a community, losing the tax base upon which its life depends, and abandoning, in many cases, not only the city of Detroit and its people, but the United States as a whole, since all of those companies have moved more and more of their production out of the country. Things have come to such a pass in Detroit that it's the largest urban bankruptcy in the history of the United States, and it's currently working through that bankruptcy, but it has now shut off water. Water is a human right. The United States is a signatory to a variety of institutions, above all the United Nations, that require the United States to provide, and I will quote, right to life as well as the right to non-discrimination concerning housing, water, and sanitation, and the highest attainable standard of health. When the United Nations heard about shutting off water, a basic human right, to people in Detroit, it sent two reporters. They're called rapporteurs. They were sent by the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights of the United Nations. Their names, in case you're interested, are Katerina de Albuquerque and Leilana Farha. They went to Detroit, they held public hearings, and they issued a report and a public defense of that report on the 20th of October of this year. And they found that the city of Detroit was violating the basic human rights of its people by shutting off their water. And I want to make a comment on that. The argument of the city is that the people whose water they shut off were too poor to pay their water bills. It's the same argument being made for the massive evictions now of people who have been too poor to pay their property taxes for homes in Detroit. And I wanted to drive home a central point. If you are a leader of a city or a state or a country where people are too poor to take care of their basic human needs that they are guaranteed as human beings, then you really have one of two choices, don't you? Either you can deny them their basic human rights, literally taking away the water on which they depend, or you can do something about their poverty so that they can afford to have the water, the sanitation, the housing, and the health care that as human beings they deserve. A decent society opts for the second choice, doing something about poverty, especially in a country where there is more wealth concentrated at the highest levels of society than perhaps in any other developed country, where the wealth is clearly there to solve the problems of poverty. It says something about the United States that Detroit's leaders want to take away the water people depend on. My second update today has to do with crooked businesses, behavior by private capitalist corporations that reaches such egregious levels of abuse of the public trust that it becomes headlines. And I want to put several of them together and then make a short comment that I hope you will be interested in about them. First, a story we have dealt with. General Motors' faulty ignitions in their cars. They have called back now, recalled millions and millions of automobiles with faulty ignitions. It is quite clear from press reports and from admissions by Mary Barra, the head of General Motors, that General Motors knew about these faulty ignitions long before it made them public. General Motors at first insisted only 13 people had been killed, as if that number was itself somehow significant. The number now admitted by General Motors and everybody else is more than twice that, 29 people killed and many, many more injured. This is a grievous failure when the majority of cars of the last several years have this problem. People are at risk. People have been killed and maimed. But it's only the first of several examples, as I promised you. The Tanaka Capitalist Corporation in Japan produces airbags that have been installed by most major automobile companies. It turns out that these airbags are faulty. It turns out that when you have an accident, when they are supposed to inflate and protect you, they also blow up, sending pieces of metal that have killed people rather than saved them and wounded many. It is a major scandal across the entire business. It's now known that there were crash tests of these airbags made quite a while ago, which indicated this problem, but were not reported to the appropriate authorities in the United States, who might, and I stress the word might, have done something about it. One can only imagine that there was money to be made by not fixing these airbags, because that would have been costly, just like there was money to be made by not addressing the ignition problems. Third example, Trinity Industries, a Texas corporation that produces highway guardrails, is now in trouble after a Texas jury has found that indeed they produced faulty highway guardrails that hurt people in significant numbers, that they apparently knew about faulty highway guardrails because of crash tests, which again they did not report to the Federal Highway Administration. Fourth example, Extendicare, one of the nation's biggest nursing home chains, has agreed in the last week to pay $38 million to settle federal claims that A, it wrongly billed the federal government for services never delivered to patients in their nursing homes, and number two, and I have to quote this because you wouldn't believe me perhaps if I just said it, that the poor care that Extendicare delivered to many of the people in the nursing home was, quote, worthless, end quote. Wow. Wow. And they're not the only company. The Ensign Group, an even larger national nursing home group, paid $48 million in 2012 for similar charges. I did a little calculation. I looked at the profits that Extendicare earned over the last 3 years, 2011, 2012, and 2013. It worked out to $768 million of profits in those 3 years. What did they have to pay to the federal government to make these charges of grotesque behavior towards the clients in a nursing home, our elderly? They had to pay $38 million. That works out to 5% of last 3 years' profits. That's called a slap on the wrist. That will prevent nothing. Here's the basic point. Private capitalist enterprises are driven by the desire and the need to maximize their profits. Will that drive, will that priority of making money. Lead them to take chances with our health, our welfare, literally our lives, the lives of the elderly that we put in nursing homes. Well, these four examples give an unequivocal answer, and they're simply the tip of an iceberg. Every day, these kinds of cases come to the public's attention. They ought long ago to have led to the following question. If the job of a car producer is to make a safe car, if the job of a nursing home operator is to make a welcome, safe environment, if the job of a highway guardrail producer is to keep us safe, why do we put those jobs in the hands of people who say that their highest priority is something else, making profits? Because then you have to ask the question, when confronted with a choice between making more profits and doing what we want and need them to do, will they choose the higher priority? Well, these four examples give us the answer. Next update. I want to, tongue-in-cheek, congratulate two senators, or I should be more careful, ex-senators of the United States Senate. One was once the leader of the Senate, Mr. Trent Lott, Republican senator from Mississippi, who left the Senate in 2007. The other one is Mr. John Breaux, B-R-E-A-U-X, a Democrat, senator from Louisiana, who left the Senate in 2005. What did the friends Trent Lott and John Breaux do after they left the Senate? What many politicians do. They formed a lobbying group. It was called the Breaux-Lott Leadership Group. Doesn't it sound nice? Here's what they did. They took money from clients, big clients, who needed something from the government in exchange for lobbying. That means talking to their former colleagues, with whom they were personal friends in the U.S. Senate, to get what the client wanted. Now, the biggest client that I could find for them during their time was AT&T, which leads lots of things from the government to make money. They started this in 2006, I believe, or perhaps 2007. In 2010, their little lobbying group was bought by a bigger one called Patton Boggs. And here's where things get fun and interesting. Patton Boggs is also a lobbying group in the nation's capital. They persuade or try to the government to do what their clients pay them to persuade the government to do. And last couple weeks, Mr. Lott and Mr. Breaux got into trouble. Why? Because it turns out that they were servicing an unusual client, namely Russia's Gazprom Bank. That's right. That's one of the banks that was cited by the federal government in sanctions to try to punish Mr. Putin of Russia for his activities in the Ukraine. So it turns out that two senators, the kind who would denounce Mr. Putin in a moment, who specialized in fomenting and fulminating about the Soviet Union and then Russia, it turns out when money is involved, they could take on the same folks as a client, persuading the government of who knows what when it comes to the question of the Ukraine. The senators follow the money. They did it ever since they left the Senate, and the least we can wonder is whether they did it when they were in the Senate, too. Next update, and we're moving quickly. I have to say something about the Ebola scare that has ricocheted across the United States. Let's be very, very clear. Ebola is a disease that has hit some of the poorest countries on the face of this earth, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, who rank literally as among the 10 poorest nations, all of them, in the world. Poverty is their problem. It makes their diet poor. It makes their health care almost non-existent. It's no surprise that a disease that shows up there spreads quickly because you have a very, very vulnerable population because of its poverty, and you have no infrastructure to deal with it. The fact that one or two of their cases come to the United States isn't really very exciting because it is spreading like wildfire in West Africa. Tens of thousands of people have this disease. It's clear that the problem is in West Africa and that the front line of defense ought to be to contain the problem there. That is, to treat quickly the people who have the problem and to take all the necessary measures to save the rest of the people there, the vast majority, from getting the disease. However, that's not being done. What's being done is a tremendous focus on hospital preparedness in the United States. We've had two cases so far. And that's not dealing with the underlying problem. Likewise, the anger against immigration from West Africa is downright ridiculous. People from all over the world are now traveling to West Africa. Then they go home to Europe, Asia, Latin America. If they take an airplane from those places to the United States, here comes the disease. Cutting off the immigration from one part of the world is childish, which is why no serious international medical care talks about this. What the United States ought to do is to send large numbers of personnel to West Africa to help, as other nations are doing. I can't forego the opportunity to mention that the country in the world that has sent the largest delegation so far of medical personnel to help deal with the problem as it should is a little island country called Cuba. In last Sunday's, that is October 19th's, New York Times, Gretchen Morgenstern, an excellent writer there, often, carries a remarkable story. It has to do with a group of hedge funds and private equity firms, they're called, led by, I'll list some of the names, Carlyle Group, Bain Capital, Kohlberg, Kravis, and Roberts, and so on. They got themselves into trouble because it turns out that they were involved in an effort to maneuver down the price of companies whose shares they then bought at a discount. You're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to play by the rules and buy shares at what the market will bear. You're not supposed to manipulate the market. They were caught manipulating the market. They admitted it, and they had to pay $115 million in fines for this manipulation. I could mention that this is, again, another illegal act violating all kinds of rules, not to speak of its unethical quality. I could add it to what we talked earlier about with General Motors and so on, but I won't. Here's what I want to point out, because Gretchen Morgenstern does such a fine job in the New York Times of October 19th. She points out that there's a rule that allows these equity funds, these wealthy capitalist funds, to pass on the cost of the fines they have to pay when they are caught in this kind of behavior onto their clients. That's right. They can do, and they did do that. And here's the punchline. Those clients of theirs include pension funds. That's right. The funds that are investing money for school teachers, for firefighters, for all kinds of public employees, and indeed some private employees, those pension funds give their money to these venture capitalists, these equity capitalist investors, to invest, to make money so that they can pay the pensions to these workers when they're 65. Those funds will now have $115 million less dollars to give to those pensioners than before because they've been able to push the fines for their illegal activity onto their clients. You have to take your hat off and shake your head in disbelief at what is going on. Well, we've taken more time for these short updates. I didn't even get to all of them, but it's more important that I bring to the fore now our visitor, our interviewee for today's program. And so let me turn now to introduce to you Dr. Aubrey Hendricks, Jr. He's been on the program once before, and I want to introduce him formally to you, so let me go through it. He is Professor Emeritus of Biblical Interpretation at the New York Theological Seminary, and currently a visiting scholar in the Department of Religion and the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University. His books include The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Nature of Jesus' Teachings and How They Have Been Corrupted, and also a book I've been reading myself recently, The Universe Bends Toward Justice, Radical Reflections on the Church, the Bible, and the Body Politic. Welcome, Aubrey. Glad to have you back.
Glad to be here. Always glad to be here with you, Rick.
Good. All right. We're going to talk today about Martin Luther King. You are a recognized authority. You've published articles. You're working now on a book on Dr. King. And I'm interested in this program in Dr. King because, as in many things, he was ahead of his time. What I mean by that is we are now living through a period in American history when our economic system, capitalism, is not performing very well for the mass of people, being questioned, being challenged, and even being opposed by more and more people. It's exploding with every passing month. So people are questioning capitalism, but it's clearly not the first time. And what's particularly interesting to me is such an enormous, important figure in American history. Way back in his life, many, many years ago, was able to figure out that there was a problem with capitalism and that we could, as a nation, do better than capitalism and that we ought to. So let me begin by asking you, can you give our listeners, our viewers, a sense of what it was in Martin Luther King's life that brought him relatively early in his life to a critical view of capitalism?
No, that's a very good question, Rick. You know, Martin Luther King had a very, very interesting upbringing because his father and his grandfather before him were preachers who were very concerned with economic inequality. And he grew up sensitized to that. And he grew up sensitized to the suffering of the people around him. So he always had a concern about economic inequality, about the travails of the poor and the impoverished. But it wasn't until he got to college, Morehouse College, with Professor Walter Cheevers, who really helped him to systematize his thinking. And it was at that point he realized that the problem that he was looking at, there weren't just individual causes of impoverishment, it was systemic. And it was at that point that he began to become a real critic of capitalism.
Are there some writings that you can recall, since you're very knowledgeable about his work? Were there some early writings or speeches or sermons or anything that he did that began to show publicly where his thinking was going about capitalism?
No, absolutely. And one of them I quoted in one of my articles in the Huffington Post, and I commend those articles to our listeners. But he wrote a letter to his future wife, Coretta. I think it was either senior year in Morehouse, his first year in seminary, which he would have still been about 19 or so. He said that he was, "I'm much more socialistic than capitalistic." He said, "Capitalism has outlived its usefulness." He said that at about 20 years old.
Okay. So now let me ask you a big question that's going to come back in our interview even a little bit later. Do the American people today, black and white, understand or recognize or know about Martin Luther King that he was a critic of capitalism? Is that understood? Is that appreciated? Is that discussed even?
Pardon me. Oh, no. Absolutely not. What the American people know is the last part of a very radical speech, that I Have a Dream speech, in which he talked about economic inequality in the beginning, but all we hear is, I have a dream that my kids can play with your kids and that kind of thing. Most Americans have no idea at all, and that's his radicality has been ignored very purposefully. And so most Americans have no idea that Martin Luther King was such a vociferous critic of capitalism, which was based on his love for humanity. He did not see that. He said that capitalism cannot take care of the needs of God's children. It's not that there's not enough to distribute, but capitalism does not distribute fairly and equitably, and so he stood diametrically opposed to capitalism.
Okay, I'm struck. I mean, I'm struck by many dimensions of what you've just said. But here's what strikes me right off the bat. During Martin Luther King's life, we had the Cold War. During that period of time, it was taboo, and it was also politically dangerous to say something critical about capitalism, because the government of the United States and the conservatives had succeeded in making a criticism of capitalism somehow be the same as siding with the Soviet Union against the United States. That made no sense, but it was something drummed into people's heads.
Right.
So it's doubly impressive that despite that taboo, despite the notion that capitalism was the best thing since sliced bread, and even if there was a problem here or there, you could fix it, that Martin Luther King said, no, this is a systemic problem, and we can and should go further. Can you help us understand what it was about capitalism that made Martin Luther King feel that strongly that he would make a systemic critique?
Well, you know, as early as 1956, King wrote in a sermon, Paul's Letter to American Christians. He was talking about the 1% back in 1956 already. Thank God for Occupy Wall Street, but King was a precursor. He prefigured that generation before. We must remember that King was not an ideologue. His concern was for what was best for humanity. He believed in love your neighbor as yourself. That means you want the same entry into opportunity and the same entry into having enough food to eat and enough clothing and shelter and all that. So he rejected a system. Forget about the name for a moment. He rejected a system that stood in the way of all of God's children being treated equitably. In other words, inequality was inherent to the system. So he opposed that inequality, that injustice. It just happened to be the result of capitalism. And that's really the reason why he was so deeply against it. But during that time, you mentioned the Cold War, he couldn't say much about it. He couldn't say really anything in this one sermon, Paul's Letter to American Christians, which is an extraordinary sermon. For a small part of the sermon, he does critique capitalism, but largely he can say nothing about it. And C.L.R. James, the very eminent Trinidad and Trotskyite Marxist, said at one point that after King's death, he said, King was as radical as any of us, but he was unable to say so because he didn't want to lose his people. He didn't want to lose the church community. So he was always there, and his concern, even with the Montgomery bus boycott, had to do with the underlying economics at the same time. He was always concerned about it, but he could only talk about inequality. He couldn't really name the systemic cause of it because of the Cold War fear of communism.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me the power of the taboo after World War II that would make people have to, in a sense, swallow things they felt deeply about. I also think we ought to take our hat off to Martin Luther King again, because here we are in the year 2014. One of the big book sensations this year is a book by Thomas Piketty called Capital in the 21st Century, and those 600-odd pages of that book establish one basic idea, that capitalism as a system produces inequality and tends to make that inequality worse unless and until people rise up and interrupt that process. But as soon as they've finished rising up, if they don't stay with it, the underlying inequality of capitalism resumes.
Right.
That's a kind of verification by the global expert in the subject that what Martin Luther King understood then was right on target.
Mm-hmm.
All right, folks, we're going to take our short break at this point in the program. Please join us in a moment. This is Economic Update. We will be right back. We're back, folks, with Dr. Aubrey Hendricks, Jr., talking about Martin Luther King. And I want to continue. I want to push this a little bit. If Martin Luther King was, even from an early age, as you explained to us, a critic of capitalism, well, the question often confronting critics is, what are you going to put in its place? Mm-hmm. How are you going to move? What is it you want instead mm-hmm. of a system that has these qualities you don't want? Mm-hmm.
Now, very good question. One thing to keep in mind is that, of course, capitalism is based on greed. A misreading of Adam Smith. Well, sort of distorted reading of Adam Smith. And greed is the third mortal sin in Christianity. And so King had to be against a system based on greed, which is what capitalism is. It's terrible, shocking, it's inhumane in many ways. He would move from a system based on greed and competition to a system based on compatibility. The word is the C word.
Compassion.
Compassion, compatibility.
Cooperation.
Cooperation. Yes, thank you. And as he looked on the landscape, he realized that democratic socialism offered the kind of possibility of community, of people caring for one another, equality of opportunity and entry. And so what he advocated, never in public, but documented in private with his staff, was for democratic socialism. And he said, call it democracy or call it democratic socialism, but we must have a better distribution of wealth and income. And so that's what he wanted. And not because he was ideological, but he saw that democratic socialism was most compatible with his faith and his love for humanity.
And so he didn't think of it as some vague, far distant in the future, utopian abstraction. It was something it is something he felt could and should be on the agenda for people here on Earth now.
No, absolutely. And because first he stressed democracy. It was democratic socialism, something that the people could vote for and support. But he saw it as a real possibility, and it is a real possibility. But he said it had to be based on a revolution of values. America, you must be born again. So he saw it as a real possibility to the extent that he was killed right before this Poor People's Campaign. The Poor People's Campaign, it's almost certain that he was going to push for some measure of democratic socialism in order to ameliorate the poverty that that campaign was to fight.
You mean push for it in a public way?
Push for it in a public way. Martin Luther King was an activist, a brilliant activist, but he wasn't a systematic thinker. He never systematized it. But he did talk about some of the things that everyone should have. Everyone should have medical care, he said. There should be universal medical care. That there should be universal employment for everyone who's able-bodied, that the government had a responsibility to make sure there's full employment. And he said that those who can't work should have a guaranteed minimum income so they could live like human beings. And those are basically democratic socialistic notions.
Right. It might even include saying that no city in this country has the right to turn off the water for human beings when it hasn't done something for their jobs or for their income.
Absolutely. He said a revolution of values, meaning that we must value human life and people over profits and profitability. We must value people over corporations, which really aren't people, persons, though the 14th misreadings of the 14th Amendment said so. So he would be he would be mortified by what they've done in Detroit and what's being advocated and done all around this country.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you about Philadelphia, how he would react. In Philadelphia, a conflict is unfolding in really staggering ways between the people who run the city, the private sector and the government leaders, and the public schools. They are basically destroying the public schools, attacking the teachers, demanding that the teachers lower their income and their status. It's already been lowered in recent years compared to what it once was. And you have a stark decision. Pennsylvania and Philadelphia are, again, very wealthy states, and a great deal of income and wealth sits at the top. That's not discussed. That the city is not going after that money is not discussed. We're told we either have cut the teachers' salaries or we attack the quality of the education in the schoolroom. Those are our two choices. As if changing the distribution of wealth and income wouldn't be a perfectly reasonable way, or maybe even a Christian way, to deal with this problem, rather than trying to pit the parents and children on the one hand against the school teachers, who both have one thing in common: they are not wealthy.
Exactly, exactly. It's a keen decry, this commodification of everything. I mean, education is being treated as a commodity, it's treated now as on the liability side of the ledger, right, not as an asset anymore. And it just shows that those at the top have lost, if they ever had, well, they've lost any semblance of responsibility and care for those who are struggling. They don't even try to hide it anymore. Right. And if you talk about redistributing some of their wealth, then they hit you with the communist and the socialist thing. King would be called a socialist. If President Obama, who's a capitalist to his heart, is called a socialist, King would be really he'd really be tarred and feathered. But I think he'd have a strong following too.
Okay, let me get to the last question I had in my list for you. How do you think, from your knowledge and your study? And some of this is addressed in the three Huffington Post articles that you've published and the work that you've done. How did Martin Luther King's criticism of capitalism as a system and preference for a democratic socialism, how did that affect his relationship on the one hand to white America and on the other hand to African-American America? How did it influence the life he led and the relationships of such an important character in our history?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the way to approach is to look at how his values help shape all of that. And first off, he was very aware of class issues. And he was aware of the role of capitalism in the perpetuation of racism. So his universalism, embracing all classes, was a big part of that, and that's why he never came out against white America. Well, that just wasn't part of his DNA, but he didn't stand against a lot. He mostly stood for. And now, in terms of African Americans, in terms of America, he proposed values, a change in values that would result in democratic socialism. But that's all he ever did, which was enough. And then he always spoke of justice. He spoke of doing the right thing or righteousness, honesty, and underlying it was always love. And so for him, democratic socialism as a system is the closest approximation to systemization of love as any that he knew.
Right. It seems to me, and I'd like your comment as a closer here, it seems to me that that approach meant that for Martin Luther King, change in America would require moving beyond capitalism to a different and better system, more aligned with his Christian values, his understanding of what Christianity meant. And that change would require and would welcome a kind of alliance of African-American and white Americans, that he could see that the majority in both communities had an interest in going in that direction, and each would be stronger with the alliance with the other in getting there. Is that a reasonable reading as you see it?
No, absolutely. We see in the Poor People's Campaign at the end of his life, he said, I'm concerned about black poor people and white poor people and Native American poor people. He saw these alliances, not just coalitions, but alliances. And that's very important to him, but also very important to King, which is not talked about much at all, but Michael Honey has a book out called All Labor Has Dignity, a collection of King's speeches to unions. King was a strong union man. And the unions, as we know, well, most of the unions were white in those days because we weren't allowed in. But he saw the importance of unions as a primary countervailing force against capitalism. And so that was interracial and many, in some ways, interclass as well. So he was a universalist. King stood against all oppression and exploitation. And he stood with all those who were exploited and mistreated and left out.
So I think it's fair then to say that we could learn a lot now from understanding Martin Luther King's goals and drives and insights, because they remain so much on the immediate agenda of this country, maybe even more now than when he articulated them.
No, absolutely, Rick. His notion of the beloved community was not just some sentimental claptrap. He saw a community that was cooperative, that was open, had open entry to all the good things of life. His notion of beloved community, of a born-again America, is a democratic socialist America. And he has his vision of everything that I've seen, and I've done a little bit of reading. His vision is the most workable for America today, if we could embrace just a significant part of that very radical vision he has for America being born again, be a much better nation. He was a visionary whose vision is not fully seen today, but some of us are working to try to change that.
And I think we may be all surprised that he comes back with a vengeance in America, not a vengeance about our situation, but he comes back with an intensity, because now, in a sense, may be the time to realize the dream he announced but wasn't capable in the society at that time, wasn't capable of bringing it to pass, that there's something terribly urgently appropriate now about what he says. Mm-hmm. And not the least of it is that those who want to make change, who are growing in number in America, want to make systemic change, may discover in the work of Martin Luther King the way to articulate that in terms of values, in terms of basic human relationships, mm-hmm. that are a necessary part of any successful social change, mm-hmm. so that people can feel the enormous stakes of making a move to change a society because of all you can win in the way of a human community.
Absolutely. And I make this comment. We talk about Martin Luther King's dream all the time. What we don't talk about is that he said his dream had turned into a nightmare. He had a new dream that everybody would have enough to eat. Everyone would have shelter and clothing. If we just took that dream and said, well, this is our goal, to fulfill this dream, we'd have a much better society and a much better world. We thank God that Martin Luther King came alive, but it's time now to really honor him by taking hold of his latter dream, his deepest dream, to change this society and that it might be born again as a just and loving society.
And I wonder to myself, as an amendment to that, whether those Americans who used to think that when Dr. King spoke about the poor, that he wasn't talking about them because they had a job, because they had an income, now as they participate in a capitalism that keeps nibbling away and destroying and undermining that, they may become aware that Martin Luther King always was talking to them too.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Obrey.
Thank you, my friend. I always enjoy being here.
All right, folks, in the time that we have left, I want to deal with a couple of your questions. The first is a bit of a substitute for the way I announced the beginning of the program. I want to answer the question many of you have very kindly and generously sent in, asking me to talk a little bit about our group, the group that produces this radio program, produces this TV version of it, and so on. We are a group of people dedicated to doing basically two things. One, talking honestly about where capitalism is as a system and not hiding its flaws and not hiding its shortcomings. And the whole point and purpose is to begin to look for and think about alternatives, ways that we can do better than the capitalism that is falling short for the vast majority of us. That's what we do. And that's what this program is about. It costs money to do this. I'm not paid, but then again, most of us either do part-time voluntary work on this, or we will occasionally be able to pay something, particularly to those who have to give nearly full time to what we do. So we are required to do fundraising. And the two websites we maintain are there not only to provide you with more information, to be an archive for all the radio programs we have ever done, they're all there, not to provide you with classes and lectures, audio files, video file, all of that's there. But there's also a way for you to contribute the money that we need to keep this process going. And for those of you that have asked about how to do it, go to the website. It'll make that all very clear. Again, the websites are rdwolf.com, that's Wolf with two Fs, and democracyatwork.info. We invite you to use them. They are available free of charge 24/7. I want also to ask you to go to those websites because there you can click on the icons for Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and that will enable you to follow our work. You can also sign up for our free newsletter, and so on. We do everything we can to communicate with you. All you have to do is sign up, and it's at your disposal. The other brief topics I want to answer questions about, the first has to do with disabled Americans. Several of you have sent me questions about that, and I want to talk about that. First, to correct any misunderstanding, what we often refer to as the Social Security system is a system that is not only, although it is primarily, to support people after age 65 who've given a lifetime of work, but it is also, the Social Security program, a way of helping people that are disabled, even before they reach age 65, with financial supports of various sorts. And I want to remind everyone what the idea here is. To become disabled with a disease, an injury, whatever it is something that can happen to anyone. A decent community, let alone one that Martin Luther King might have called a loving community, recognizes the absurdity, the randomness with which disability strikes, and says we can all set aside a little bit to help those of us that fall into that misfortune. It's a way of taking care of one another that makes our community a loving community. The alternative is to say to the person afflicted by a disability, we don't care about you. Go off into the corner. Live a life of neglect. Die. We don't want to do that. We don't want to be part of such a community. We don't want to do that kind of interacting. So we have created supports for people who are disabled. However, in the crisis that hit since 2007, many of those supports have been withdrawn or cut back. And that is a cruelty to those least able to cope with them, which includes our disabled. And therefore, it is a serious issue that deserves comment, especially in a society that has such an extraordinary collection of wealth at the top that there literally is no excuse, since all the resources are there to treat our disabled brothers and sisters in a decent, humane, caring way. Now imagine in that circumstance the reaction when, in Great Britain over the last 2 or 3 weeks, a scandal erupts. What is the scandal? Well, Great Britain has a welfare minister. His name is Lord, I kid you not, because Britain still does that, Lord Freud, spelled just like Sigmund, but of course it isn't Sigmund, Lord Freud. He made a comment that got him into big trouble, that disabled workers, he said, are not worth being paid the minimum wage. My goodness. In other words, if you're disabled, not only is the society not supposed to be able to help you the way it could with the extra that you need because you've been afflicted by a disablement that could happen to anyone, but we ought to be allowed, says the Conservative Party welfare minister, to pay you much less than the minimum wage. What was the idea in this man's mind? Well, clearly, the notion of the disabled as somebody who's a brother or a sister and deserves and needs our help was not in his mind. At least it wasn't uppermost, and the way he spoke probably wasn't there at all. Instead, he was articulating an idea that deserves as strenuous a criticism as I know how to give. The idea is this: the wage you get ought to be measured by your productivity. In other words, if a disabled person can't do as much on the job as somebody else, well, then we should pay him less. Folks, this has been the excuse of rich people since day one. Rich people need to persuade the rest of us, not that they're rich and that that's why we aren't rich, we are poor so that they can be rich. Oh no. They want us to believe that they're rich because they're more productive than we are. In other words, they do more, they produce more, so that's why they deserve more. And our poverty is our fault because we're not productive. Now, let's see. Bill Gates owns tens of billions of dollars, whereas the people working in his company don't get anywhere near remotely like that. Is Bill Gates more productive? Well, wait a minute. Bill Gates isn't working at Microsoft anymore. In fact, Bill Gates isn't working at all. What do you mean he's more productive? Productivity has nothing to do with it. 40 years ago, big executives in major American corporations averaged about 40 times the income of their average employees. Today, they're 250 times. You think they got more wealthy because they're productivity increased? They're doing the same jobs now they did then. They just gave themselves more money. The notion that we pay people because of their productivity is bizarre and makes no sense. And final thought, your productivity, whatever that is, sure as heck doesn't start and end at your job. What about your productivity in the community? What about your productivity in your family? What about your productivity in your neighborhood? We don't pay you for that. A disabled person can be an inspiration to everyone in the neighborhood and in their family. They can support the family emotionally 10 different ways. They can be among the most productive people in the world. But we don't count that, do we? We say we're going to pay you money only if you're making money for some employer. What a bizarre idea. We ought to be ashamed of a society that thinks you pay a person, you enable a person to live, to eat, to be a good husband or wife or child or neighbor, a good comrade in the union, and then pay them only for what they do for whoever employs them. Makes no sense to me. Final point. You've asked about deficits. Has the deficit in the United States decreased? Yes, it has. Obama last year raised the payroll tax again by 50%, bringing much more money into the government. And under the pressure of Republicans, he cut spending of all kinds. If the government raises more money from us and spends less money on us, it's going to make the deficit less. The government has more and spends less. Its deficit is smaller. Is that a good thing? Not at all. Not even close. Here's what happened. With families pressed by the rising payroll taxes held back from their salaries, with families pressed by reduced government services in the schools, in the garbage pickup, in the social worker, all of the rest. Families are under incredible extra pressure. Plus, they've just gone through 5 years of an economic crisis that has wiped out whatever savings they could have accumulated. So you know what's happening? People are being forced to go back to work because they can't live otherwise. And the business community is taking advantage by saying, okay, here's a job, pays you half of what you used to get. But we know you're so desperate, you'll take the job because the alternative is even worse. That's why our unemployment numbers are going down. We have cut the deficit, forcing people to work for less. This is not a sustainable arrangement. It certainly does not conform to any idea Martin Luther King ever had of a loving community. It's long past time we recognize these situations and make the changes that are so overdue. Thank you once again. I want to remind you, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info are the places to go to follow up and to show your support, and we thank you for it.